So what happens when you're a pastor and you find out who Jesus Yeshua really is and where Israel really fits?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, what happens? You're a pastor of a church, you're a Christian leader, and you rediscover aspects of the Jewish roots of the faith. Not that Gentiles are supposed to become Jews, not that it's a matter of putting on outward garments, but you begin to recognize that in your thinking you had Christianized Jesus, and now you recognize him as the Messiah of Israel, as Yeshua. What happens? Why does that matter? A little while, I'm going to be speaking with author Jacob Fronczak. I've got two brand new books on my desk. Yeshua Matters, Putting the Jewish Rabbi Back at the Center of Christianity, and Israel Matters. Ooh, what happens when you recognize Israel's role in salvation? Putting the Jewish people back at the center of God's plan. I'll be talking to Jacob in a moment, and there's a special offer from the ministry that Jacob works with, First Fruits of Zion. There's a special offer for our Line of Fire listeners. We'll be telling you about that in a few minutes at their website. Yesterday afternoon, I had a second debate with Don Preston, who is a preterist scholar. He believes that all of the prophecies about the second coming of Jesus and the new heavens and new earth and all of these things were already fulfilled, that they were fulfilled with the destruction of Jerusalem in the year 70, and that we have been living in this era of new heavens and new earth, that we have been spiritually resurrected, that these things already have taken place. We debated the first time on the meaning of all Israel shall be saved in Romans 11, and then at his request, he had approached me both times, but pressed, look, there was a lot of interest in the first debate. Let's have a second debate, and we'll discuss the meaning of the fullness of the Gentiles. And he is a very gracious Christian brother. We had a very friendly dialogue in the midst of our differences. I have to say, though, that I find the positions espoused to be very, very disturbing. And I made that plain during the debate as well. The idea that God forever finished dealing with Israel as a nation with the year 70 AD and the destruction of the temple, I find that to be an absolute assault on the promises of God and the character of God, and the fact that he made a one-way covenant with Abram, and that it's on him to keep the covenant. The idea that he could then say, okay, we're done, is to me utterly unscriptural and does open the door towards hostility towards Israel and the Jewish people, although I don't believe Don Preston has any of that in his own heart at all from my interaction and dealing with him. The idea that there will be no bodily resurrection, that all of the explicitly clear passages in the New Testament that talk about physical resurrection, the bodily resurrection that we're looking forward to, that those have been spiritually fulfilled and that there will not be a bodily resurrection, I find that to be a real gross and serious misinterpretation of Scripture. We'll put up a link where you can watch that debate. Again, you'll find it to be a civil debate between two gentlemen who are serious students of the Word. And if you get a chance to watch it, I'd be curious to hear your feelings. If you're listening and you believe in preterism, full preterism, that all of these prophecies have already been fulfilled, all past, if you believe that, by all means, call me and explain to me how God could break his promises to Israel. By all means, call me, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Explain to me how God could go back on his word. Explain to me how explicit prophecies about a physical resurrection and explicit prophecies about universal peace on earth and the glory of the Lord filling the earth, how those things have already been fulfilled when we are nowhere near seeing that happen. 866-34-TRUTH. We'll be right back with Jacob Fronczak.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Yes, yes, yes. That music tells you it's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday here on The Line of Fire. Michael Brown, welcome to the broadcast. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. My guest, Jacob Fronczak, is a Baptist pastor, teacher, writer, and a project matter with First Fruits of Zion. And he's written two books. I've got them in my hands right now, beautifully produced, as the materials always are from First Fruits of Zion. Yeshua Matters, putting the Jewish rabbi back at the center of Christianity, and Israel Matters, putting the Jewish people back at the center of God's plan. Jacob, welcome to The Line of Fire.
Thanks, Dr. Brown. It's an honor to be on the show with you today.
Well, glad to have you on. Jacob, explain to me how a Baptist pastor ends up working for First Fruits of Zion, which is a ministry that helps Christians understand the Jewish roots of their faith and helps Jewish believers understand what it means to be a Jewish follower of Jesus. How do you, as a Baptist pastor, end up with First Fruits of Zion?
Well, I'm non-denominational now, just so you know. I planted a church about a year ago called East Point Community Church, and we're not affiliated with any denomination, but we do baptize adults, so I guess technically we're Baptists. But I started on this journey toward the Jewish roots of my faith probably over a decade ago, and it took me some time to sort of get my bearings, and I was reading the Old Testament and trying to figure out why we didn't do these certain things in the Old Testament anymore, the dietary laws and the holidays and so forth, And I eventually ended up in sort of what you call, I guess, the Hebrew Roots movement. And I was at a feast site celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles, and I actually met Boaz Michael, the founder and director of First Fruits of Zion. And he granted me a very gracious corrective to some of the things that I had learned and gotten into. And I just sort of found my way back into the mainstream church with a desire to bring all the things that I found that were good in that movement, the Jewishness of Jesus, and what that means for the Christian world as a whole, back into the church.
All right, let's first talk about what was wrong, some of the errors when you got into the Hebrew Roots movement, because a lot of people from the outside, looking in other words, those who have no clue what we talk about Hebrew roots or Jewish roots or recognizing the biblical calendar, or it pretty much all gets put in one category. And there are some weird things out there, some real extremes, some things that I, as a Jewish believer of Jesus, teach against and reject. But you were searching for truth. You were trying to figure out why, as followers of Jesus today, we seem so detached from Old Testament law, etc. And you swing a little too far, as often happens with the pendulum, and you swing into the Hebrew Roots movement. What do you mean by Hebrew Roots movement, and what was wrong with it?
It's hard to categorize, you know, the Hebrew Roots movement. It's hard to make a statement that covers all of it. There's just so much diversity out there, and there's so many different things that sort of fall under that umbrella. The particular things that initially appealed to me and that I sort of fell into was this idea that, you know, even as a Gentile follower of Jesus, the Old Testament law applied to me just as if I had been a Jewish person born into the Sinai Covenant, and I had this firm obligation to follow all the laws of the Torah, the dietary laws and the commandments. And one of the more harmful things I think about where I was in that movement is that all these things were understood with no reference to how they're, like, traditionally worked out in a Jewish community. People just sort of invented their own ways to do all the feasts and to tie tzitzit and things, and it was totally removed from Jewish tradition and from Jewish community.
What about the idea of Gentile believers feeling obligated to keep the law of Moses, and that somehow their salvation depended on observance of the law of Moses? What negative effect did that have?
I'm not sure that there was a lot of legalism in that sense, where people thought that they were going to be saved because of these things, but they certainly felt that it was an obligation that they had to take on, and they would place it pretty freely upon other believers as well.
All right, and so you end up judging the rest of the body. If you don't keep a seventh-day Sabbath, you're not fully pleasing to God. If you don't keep the biblical feasts and holidays, you're not fully pleasing to God. And on it goes. So it does become binding for some. It can become legalistic, but certainly can be very judgmental. And then, as you said, it ends up with just everybody kind of doing everything. And it, no pun intended, it ends up really out on the fringes. So Boaz Michael helped bring some correction there. But what is the truth? Why does it matter that we put the Jewish rabbi back at the center of Christianity? What's been added to your own spiritual life, to your own congregation? Look, if I just preach Jesus, he died, he rose, he's the Savior, he's the Lord, what can you add to that? What is putting the Jewish rabbi back at the center of Christianity add to the faith that other Christians have?
You know, I think there's so much confusion surrounding biblical interpretation. There's so much out there. There's so many ideas. There's multitudes of churches and denominations that are all teaching different things based on just their impression of what Jesus said and their impression of what Paul said. When we return Jesus, the Jewish rabbi, back to the center of our faith, and we read his teachings in a Jewish context, we have a lot less wiggle room. We have a lot less confusion. And there's a lot less chance that we're going to take something he said totally out of its context, because we're going to be reading him within the context of first century Judaism.
All right, give me an example that you deal with in your book, Yeshua Matters.
Yeshua Matters doesn't come to really strong practical conclusions in that area, because I spend most of my time just talking about how Jesus should be understood as a Jew. But one thing I do hit on is the idea of discipleship. Discipleship, I think if you were to go to 9 out of 10 churches that offer a discipleship program, you know, what you're going to be learning is the specific theology of that church or denomination. Whereas discipleship, you know, following Jesus is a process of being molded into his image, learning what he taught, and living those things out in your life.
Right. So the Jewish model of discipleship versus what we often think of as discipleship in the church, where you're just teaching someone foundational doctrines, are very different. And in the Jewish context, of course, Rabbi Yeshua calling his disciples to follow him was a holistic learn from me and live accordingly. Jacob, what's happened in your own life, in your own congregation, as these things have become real to you? What has been the positive practical benefit?
You know, one positive practical benefit that I personally have seen and I've been able to introduce in the lives of others has to do with some of the things that we've seen happen in the country as far as the shift toward the embracing and upholding and affirming of same-sex marriages. And there have been a lot of Christians who pull sayings of Jesus, like we should love each other as he loved us, and we should love our neighbor as ourselves, to say, look, this is just love, and this is something that Jesus stood for. Whereas when you read him as a first-century Jewish rabbi, there's no chance that you're going to read that into what he's saying, because the forbidden sexual relationships in Judaism are well known, and we would just expect that he would have adopted those same prohibitions.
So, in other words, the New Testament is not just floating out there; it is grounded in that which has come before. It is grounded in the revelation of the Hebrew Scriptures, grounded in the revelation of what we refer to as the Old Testament, and then the context is the Jewish believing culture of that day. So as I often say, when you're building a house and you get to the second story, you don't knock out the first story, you build on the first story and then get to the second story. So just briefly, give us an overview of what you deal with in the book Yeshua Matters.
Yeshua Matters starts with sort of the story of how I came to the realization that Jesus was not just a Jewish person, but a Jew who practiced Judaism, a practicing Jewish rabbi. And that journey for me started when I was in college and I was having this sort of a crisis of faith, because I didn't understand Jesus. He just didn't make a lot of sense to me as a human, as a person, until I discovered that he was a Jewish rabbi and is, present tense, a Jewish rabbi. And then I sort of paint a portrait of Jesus from the Gospels, trying to recontextualize some concepts that are familiar to us in Jewish terms. Like, for example, he's our king. What does that mean? If you have a king, that means you have to do what he says. His commandments are non-negotiable. He's our redeemer. Well, what does that mean? It means that, yes, he buys us out from the power of sin, but it also means he's going to redeem the Jewish people and bring them back to their land.
Got it. All right. Tell you what, we've got a break coming up. Friends, if you want to find out more about these two books, Yeshua Matters and Israel Matters, and get them at a special discount, go now to First Fruits of Zion website. That's FFOZ.com. FFOZ.com. All right. When you get there, you order the books and then use Line of Fire Radio. That's your code when you're checking out. Line of Fire Radio. I'll make sure it's Line of Fire Radio or Line of Fire. I'll confirm that for you in a moment. Stay tuned.
God of light, hear our cry. Send the fire.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to the Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. Okay, if you want to order these two books at a special discount on the First Fruits of Zion website, Yeshua Matters, putting the Jewish rabbi back at the center of Christianity, and Israel Matters, putting the Jewish people back at the center of God's plan, by Jacob Franczak. Go to First Fruits of Zion, that's FFOZ.com, and then when you order, when you're checking out, in all caps, use Line of Fire. All right, Line of Fire is one word, all caps, and you'll get a special discount. This is just for you, our Line of Fire listeners. Jacob, how has the church been negatively affected through the centuries by not understanding God's plan for the Jewish people?
You know, anti-Semitism in the church has been this extraordinary, an extraordinarily tragic development that we see from the second century onward. I think it has totally handicapped our ability as Christians to show Jesus to the Jewish people. We're showing them this person that is asking them to renounce Jewishness, to renounce Jewish identity, to renounce their customs, to renounce their laws. And I don't think Jesus asks the Jewish people to do any of those things. But because of our anti-Judaism and anti-Semitism, because we forgot that Jesus was a practicing Jew, we've held up this picture of Jesus. It doesn't make any sense to the Jewish people.
What about the affecting the church itself? What about the impact on the church, on believers in Jesus, if we have not understood God's purposes for Israel? Does that hurt followers of Jesus as well as Jews who don't know Jesus?
I think that it does. I think, you know, when you see that you pointed out on your show that there's these denominations that move away from traditional Christian values, and a few things seem to go together. This anti-Israel, anti-Zionist stance seems to run right along with this sort of permissiveness toward various kinds of sexual activity. And I think that those, you know, there's, like you said, there's this deep spiritual deficit that comes with not having a vital connection to the Jewish Jesus and with not having a vital connection to the Jewish people. I think we can learn so much from Judaism when Jesus says, you know, when Paul says, be careful what comes out of your mouth. We can learn from Judaism how seriously they take that and how structured and how careful, you know, an observant Jew is with the things that they say. And with modesty and so many other areas, we can learn so much from Jewish traditions.
All right. In your book, Israel Matters, Putting the Jewish People Back at the Center of God's Plan. And by the way, the website is FFOZ.org, not .com. It's .org. My apologies there. But in your book, Israel Matters, you share who you are and starting. You give definitions: Jewish people, nations, church, Israel. What's the difference between the church and Israel, and is there overlap between the two?
I think that there is overlap. I think that the church, you could say, is all the people from all nations who have been called to follow Jesus, to become disciples of Jesus, to believe in Jesus and attach themselves to him. I think Israel, very clearly, refers to the Jewish people, and of course we do have Jewish people who are followers of Jesus and disciples of Jesus, and they would fall into both categories. I do think in some sense that a Christian who attaches himself to Jesus becomes part of what Paul calls in Ephesians this sort of commonwealth of Israel. But I think it's important not to confuse that with becoming a Jewish person or becoming part of, you know, the nation of Israel.
Right. So does God still have promises that apply to the nation of Israel, or are there just individual promises for individual Jews to be saved? And if we say that God does not have promises that remain for Israel, what does that tell us about his integrity?
Yeah, I think that there are so many promises to Israel, to the nation of Israel, that have not yet found their fulfillment. And I believe that if God doesn't fulfill those promises, you know, he even says, you know, in Ezekiel chapter 36, that he's going to do these things to vindicate his name among the nations, to uphold his integrity, to show the nations that he's not too weak and that he doesn't go back on his word. And for us to embrace this idea that, well, he is kind of going back on his word by not fulfilling these very literal promises to Israel, it paints a picture of God and of Jesus that's very confusing and I think is contradictory.
Yeah, when I was doing a couple of recent debates with scholars who are full preterists or partial preterists, so looking at many of the promises in the Bible as already being fulfilled or all being fulfilled, what I noticed was the common theme of the judgment on Israel was literal, but the promised restoration is spiritual. It's almost like God says, "And I will judge you in my wrath," that's the Jews, "and I will regather you in my mercy," that's the church. There's a certain schizophrenia there. And the principle that John uses in 1 John, that if you don't love your brother whom you can see, how can you love God whom you can't see? We can make a certain application. If God can't keep or won't keep his promises to the physical people that you can see, how can we be so sure he's going to keep his spiritual promises to an invisible, invisibly defined group? So it really does impinge on the character of God. Jacob, are you finding that more and more people are catching hold of this message about why Israel matters, or are we in danger of losing it again as it's been lost through much of church history?
I think it is growing, but the reason I wrote the books, obviously, is because I think that there's so much more work that needs to be done in these areas. There are other growing segments of Christianity that are very anti-Israel and that are very anti-Zionist. I think it's important to sort of counter that and to come out with a strong message that, no, Jesus is Jewish. He's always going to be Jewish. He's the king of the Jews, and he will come back and redeem his people, Israel, in a very literal sense. But, yeah, there's growth. There's people that are catching on to this that haven't before, especially younger people who are not satisfied with the traditional answers they've been given to these questions. They're searching the scriptures. They're finding Jesus as a practicing Jew, and they're coming to this realization, and I hope to be able to sort of steer them away from some of the mistakes I've made and into a really healthy and grounded understanding of Rabbi Yeshua.
Good. These are meat and potato books full of scripture, but also very practical, clearly laid out. If you go to First Fruits of Zion, FFOZ.org, and when you check out, put in the code Line of Fire, all caps, Line of Fire. It's just for you, our radio listeners. You can get both books for just $10 each, which is a super deal. So visit the website there, FFOZ.org, the two books, Israel Matters and Yeshua Matters by Jacob Fronczak. Hey, thanks for taking the time to lay these out in such a practical and clear way, and keep exalting Jesus Yeshua in the midst of the church.
Thanks, you too.
All right. Hey, friends, you got a question. I want you to get on the phones right now. Even if you're not going to be listening on radio, get on the phones right now. You've got a Jewish-related question. I'm going to be taking Jewish questions. 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. All right? You can get on the phones now. I'll be taking Jewish-related questions. If you post them on my Facebook page, I'm going to be answering questions there. If you appreciate the work that we're doing, stand with us on the front lines. Would you just take a moment and pray today and say, Lord, how can we stand with Mike Brown on the front lines of Jewish ministry? Whatever the Lord lays on your heart, do that. Would you?
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Yeah, I was just in Israel. I was just in Israel not too many days ago. 866-34-TRUTH. You've got Jewish-related questions. We've got Jewish-related answers for you. Before I get into any of your questions, the number to call, 866-348-7884. So it could be a Hebrew question. It could be a question having to do with Israel today. It could be a question having to do with Israel and prophecy. It could be a question having to do with Jewish background to the New Testament or Jewish tradition in general. If we don't have answers for you, we will do our best to get them for you. Okay. Dennis, grab clips number 14 and 15. Robert Martin, this is his YouTube channel description. For those ignorant people who believe the Israeli propaganda, wake the heck up. I substituted the word there. The Palestinian people are protesting peacefully. It's the Israeli armed forces that are the aggressors. They kill innocent civilians, target their homes and livelihoods on a daily basis, and cry self-defense. The smoke you see is caused by the aggressive use of tear gas and other inhumane weapons Israeli soldiers use against civilians. The Israelis dictate the rhetoric to suit their own objectives, and the world hangs on their every word to the detriment of the Palestinians. Don't believe the lies. You're told that a Palestinian will wear face coverings to hide their identity. The truth is they do this to protect themselves from the inhumane and often illegal use of gas by the Israeli armed forces. The truth is there. You just have to listen. And he's got these hashtags, Wake Up World and Free Palestine. Now, obviously, he's not the leader of a country. He is someone with a YouTube channel. But this is the type of stuff that's out there. This is the type of rhetoric that's out there. This is the type of hate-filled speech and misinformation that's out there. Let's analyze one thing here. Why the Palestinians wear face coverings? It's not to hide their identity. It's because of Israeli tear gas. So Jihadi John, as he's called, the murderous, barbaric ISIS killer with British accent, when he wears his face covering in the middle of Iraqi or Syrian desert, it's because of Israeli tear gas. Aha! And when ISIS murderers beheaded Ethiopian Christians or Libyan Christians, beheaded them or shot them, and they were all wearing their face coverings, it was because of Israeli tear gas. What kind of nonsense and idiocy is this? Let's listen to clip number 14, some of the anti-Semitic rhetoric that's out there.
I started doing a lot of reading because I couldn't comprehend that an army could do this sort of thing and kill children on a regular basis whilst the world watched. And yet they were crying self-defense. So as I read, I started to see that Hamas has nothing to do with it. It's Israel, and what they're trying to do is to steal land. It's the Zionists trying to take over someone else's land.
Tell you what. Go to Israel, live there. Go to places where Arabs and Jews work side by side, live side by side, do business side by side, and live without conflict. Why? Because Israel is happy to have that. Then watch what happens when people try to murder Israelis. Watch the restraint that Israel uses more than virtually any army has used in recorded history. Watch that. Watch how they are repaid by Palestinian terrorists who celebrate the deaths of Israeli men, women, and children. Watch how Palestinians, I'm talking about the terrorists, endanger their own people and then turn around and blame Israel? That's perverse. That's perverse.
The Zionists are a sick cult. They are the sickest cult that you and I have ever seen. But yet they get on mainstream media and say, we're protecting ourselves. They are not.
Yeah. Friends, there is an increasing wave of Jew hatred rising around the world. We are watching it unfold in front of our eyes. It begins with a hatred of Israel, and it quickly becomes a hatred of Jews in general. When you talk to Palestinians who are aggrieved, now look, plenty of them are living in substandard conditions and some in miserable conditions, but it's not the fault of Israel. Israel would gladly see peaceful solutions where everybody is prospering. The problem remains that the Palestinian leadership is hurting the people by for decades now, not agreeing to do what's best for the people, but rather saying we want all the land back, period. And now we want the right of return for generations of people who've been born outside of where they may have or their ancestors may have grown up. So that it would mean basically that, let's say you had people that left a particular country as refugees during a war, and they lived outside of that country for 100 years. Let's say there were 100,000 when they left, and 100 years later there are 1 million. Now the million say, oh, we have a right to go back, even though we've been repatriated in other countries. Well, but the Palestinians, the leadership, will not repatriate them. The other countries will not repatriate them. So here you have Arabic-speaking countries. You have countries of the same religion, Islam. You have neighbors. So certainly the Palestinians could now become citizens of Saudi Arabia or citizens of Egypt or citizens of Jordan or citizens of Lebanon or citizens of Syria, with the exception of some incorporation into Jordan. No, you're going to live as refugees, even within the Palestinian Authority. So this is the so-called West Bank. Even within the Palestinian Authority, there are still Palestinian refugee camps. You can go to Lebanon and Syria, Arabic-speaking countries, largely Islamic countries, and there are Palestinian refugee camps there. Why? Because these Arabic-speaking countries will not repatriate their own people. Why? It is an ongoing ideological war against Israel. This is not some new revelation. This is something that's been known for decades and decades, but it is now being used as a weapon to bash Israel and smash Israel. And of course, Israel doesn't do everything perfectly. And of course, Israel has shortcomings. So all you need to do is focus on those and then play into these suspicions about the Jews. The Jews, always the Jews. So as I started to say, when you will listen to Palestinians who hate Israel, and not all Palestinians do hate Israel. In fact, my friend Caleb Myers, who's a Messianic Jewish attorney in Israel and fighting for justice for all, he does talks together with Palestinians where they say that working with Israel is the best way to find a good solution for the good of the Palestinians, and they're suffering under their own leaders. So there is a documentary. This is on thejc.com, reported yesterday. A BBC documentary, Sandy Rushdie reporting, a BBC documentary. And in the documentary, you've got a lot of Arabic being spoken. So you have running text, okay? You have running text as the documentary is quoting people speaking Arabic, and now you have English translation. And throughout the documentary, as the Palestinians are saying Yahud, 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 which is Jew, okay? The Jews, the Jews, the Jews, the Jews. And it's an hour-long documentary called Children of the Gaza War, and it's obviously not Israel-friendly. Throughout the documentary, every time they say Jew, a Gazan child says the Yahud, the Jews, are massacring Palestinians. The subtitles read Israel is massacring us. And so the woman who's put this together, Lise Doucette, She said, we talk to people in Gaza, we talk to translators. When they say Jews, they mean Israelis. We felt it was a better translation of it. She said, we checked this again yesterday. We're not trying to cover it up. We took advice on it, and that was the advice we were given by translators. Ah, but do you think then when they say Jews, they're making a distinction? When they say Jews, they don't mean Jews? When they say Jews, they say, well, we say Jews, but we only mean Israelis. We don't mean Jews in general, that there's not a demonizing of Jews in a more widespread way. She said she was determined to tell the story from the perspective of children. What do these kids watch on Palestinian State TV? What do they watch on Hamas-run TV? What kind of propaganda are they fed? What kind of Jew hatred are they fed? You want to find out? You want to find out? Go to palwatch.org, P-A-L-W-A-T-C-H, palwatch.org, and see yourself, text and video and audio, of what they are being taught on Palestinian State TV. Go to memorytv.org, M-E-M-R-I-T-V, memorytv.org. Go there and see what they are being fed in the radical Muslim world. These are actual transcripts. These are actual quotes. These are actual videos from the TV shows, from sermons in mosques. It will take your breath away. That's what the parents are hearing. The kids are receiving this type of propaganda in their schools and through the media. Liz Doucette says, some of the most compelling stories and often the acts of courage come from young children. If we want to not just try to understand what is happening in these wars, but also get a glimpse into the future, then I think we have to talk to and hear the children. It tells us a lot about the times we live in, and it tells us a lot about the times that lay ahead. Unfortunately, these children have been terribly indoctrinated. All right. Let me respond to some of your questions. Let's see. Well, here's one on Twitter from Jess. Isaiah 4:1. What is the significance or allusion of seven women taking hold of one man? Well, obviously, society is in bad shape when men are dying in war or dying in other ways, and you now have this massive population imbalance, so that seven women are just grabbing hold of one man, saying, "Hey, you know, you lead us and you help us." So it's when men are decimated in the population, when men can't lead, when men can't provide, it's a sign of real judgment. It's a sign of serious problems in the society. 866-34-TRUTH. Let me grab a Facebook question or two. Let's see. Jen asked this. I have a question regarding the Hebrew Roots movement. Is it a cult? Why such emphasis on the Torah? Didn't Jesus fulfill the old laws when he died on the cross? This belief has transformed my parents and not for the better. It's brought so much heartbreak to our family and has broken the family apart. My parents are shells of what they used to be in the faith after following this movement. I pray the Lord will open their eyes and hearts to the truth. Okay, there are different aspects to the Hebrew Roots movement. Some of it would be full-blown cult. Some of it is sacred name, and the names are wrong. You have to say Yahushua or things like that, and so they get the names wrong, Yahshua, and you know, Yahuwah, and these different names. So they get into sacred name stuff, and they say that Torah observance is mandatory for all followers of Jesus, Jew and Gentile alike. And then some of them go as far as finding a Jewish identity or an identity of one of the 12 tribes of Israel. And, so has many cult-like tendencies in that respect. Some in their extremes deny certain parts of the New Testament as being inspired. What we should have is a healthy appreciation for the Torah, for God's holy law and instruction. In my book, Hyper Grace, I have a whole chapter called The Law of the Lord is Good. And in that chapter, I lay out the positive value of the law of God, what all believers can learn, how we can learn about God's holiness, how we could learn about things that please him. There are other things that we can learn. The calendar, his prophetic working in the earth, we can learn many of those things. That is the foundation But now the foundation is built into a new and better covenant. And believers are not under obligation to keep a seventh-day Sabbath or to keep the dietary laws. And what I found, it goes back to what I believe is a true word the Lord spoke to me in 1984, that the temptation of being Jewish, oh, Jew, I got to be Jewish, Jewish, that the temptation is a soulish one, and it will fascinate, stimulate, complicate, suffocate. Let me repeat it. It is a soulish temptation that will fascinate, stimulate, complicate, suffocate. I'll explain exactly what I mean by that when we come back on the other side of the break.
Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
So let me explain what I mean by the Jewish temptation, something I believe God spoke to me over 30 years ago, that the, quote, Jewish temptation is soulish. It's in the soul realm. In other words, the realm of the emotions, as opposed to the realm of absolute spiritual truth. It will fascinate, stimulate, complicate, suffocate. Now, I've checked this out, all right? I have checked this out for decades. I have watched this. I can't tell you how many people have told me they have seen this unfold, this exact same thing unfold. But here's the progression. Wow, I never knew that. That's fascinating. It's Jewish background. That's really neat. Now, good. I'm with you. I'm all with you so far. A lot of fascinating things. Now it goes a little further. Stimulate. Boy, you know, we are just so excited about reading the Bible now, and we are just so excited about Sabbath observance, and we are. But the problem is it's a mixture now. It's a mixture because you're telling people that they're obligated to keep the law of Moses. It's a mixture because you're not understanding the meaning of Yeshua fulfilling things. He did not abolish. He fulfilled. But you're not understanding the meaning of that. And now somehow spirituality is tied in with Jewishness. The more Jewish you can be, the more spiritual you are. So here's the progression. Fascinate. Wow, I never knew that. That's it. Oh, that is so interesting. Stimulate. Oh, boy, you know, we are so into this new study now. We're getting all these books on Jewish background. It is really, really neat. Then complicate. Well, okay, I mean, we're doing the Sabbath now. We're observing the Sabbath, but, you know, the new moons, those are important too. So, I mean, what are we supposed to celebrate for the new moons? Okay, the other thing is, I mean, I'm getting convicted now. I'm not thinking, you know, I was wearing this clothes. It's like mixing two different kinds of garments. And, oh, boy, what do we do at Christmas? I mean, that's a pagan holiday, and our family celebrates. I guess we can't celebrate Christmas, complicate, and then suffocate. Next thing, you look at those people, and just as this one woman described on Facebook, the people are a shell of themselves. Their prayer lives are next to nothing. They're not sharing the gospel with people. They're not worshiping freely. And I have seen people, Gentiles, go so far that they ultimately converted to Judaism and denied Jesus. They went so far that they converted to Judaism and denied Jesus as the Messiah. You say, well, it's just best then to stay away from Jewish roots. No, no, no. It's best to keep focused on Jesus Yeshua. Let me repeat that. It's best to keep focused on Jesus Yeshua as central, the Savior and the Lord. It is best to stay in intimate relationship with God, fellowship with God through prayer and worship and the Word, and then to recover the Jewish roots of the faith, that we understand that Jesus did not come into this world to establish a new home and garden religion called Christianity, but rather to inaugurate the kingdom of God, that he was a rabbi, not a reverend, that by understanding the Old Testament roots and the Jewish backdrop to the New Testament, that our own faith is enriched as Jews or as Gentiles. By understanding the biblical calendar, we see what God has done in the past and what he will do in the future. By understanding God's faithfulness to Israel, we will see his faithfulness to the church. We will understand dimensions of what's happening in the world today. There'll be a greater depth to much of the teaching and insights that we have into the word. But spirituality is found in Yeshua, not in Jewishness. Kerrigan asked this via Twitter. What do you think will happen to America in September in light of the SCOTUS ruling, Supreme Court ruling, and the Shemitah that is coming up? I don't know. Honestly, don't know. I know that we're in ongoing shaking. Roe v. Wade, an absolutely horrific, mind-numbingly horrific Supreme Court decision that has brought terrible devastation to our nation. 55 million lives lost. And all the damage done to the women who've had abortions and the men that were complicit in abortions and on and on. Terrible, terrible damage. And yet the sky didn't fall in that respect. Think of it like this. When Nadab and Abihu sinned in Leviticus 10 and when Ananias and Sapphira sinned in Acts 5, it was right at the beginning of God introducing the tabernacle in his presence to ancient Israel. And God's Spirit coming in the early church, the early ecclesia among the believers. And there was an instant judgment. But then you have Israel doing far worse things for decades, even for centuries, before judgment came. But then when it came, it was devastating. It affected the whole nation. So we're already seeing the negative fruits of the ruling. We're already seeing the ongoing hostility towards the people of God and the deepening confusion about the meaning of marriage and gender and so on. We are already suffering the consequences in that respect. With Shemitah coming up, if there is significance to the seventh-year cycle, as my friend Jonathan Kahn persuasively argues, is this another time of major shaking? As Jonathan says, God doesn't have to do anything. This is not an obligation that he has to do anything. He and I just met and discussed it. He himself doesn't know what's coming as much as he knows and is convicted of the fact that there is a pattern. But if something does happen with so much talk before it, it would absolutely, absolutely have to get our attention big time, big time, big time. It would absolutely have to get our attention to the point that we are recognizing God is shaking our nation. Now, we should be on our knees, on our faces anyway, but all the more with that being the case. All right, there's some great questions I'm looking at on Twitter. There are more questions to answer on Facebook, so I'm going to be answering those. If you'd like to call in with a question, I'll be taking calls in the next hour, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. So let me tell you a story. My friend, Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, known as Rabbi to the Stars or America's favorite rabbi or most famous rabbi, a few years back, he wrote a book called Kosher Jesus. It was based on years of research and writing he had done. And in it, he said that the New Testament misrepresented who Jesus was, that the real Jesus was a great rabbi and teacher and a freedom fighter against Rome. He was not a false Messiah, but a failed Messiah. We should find out what he really said, glean that from some of what's in the New Testament, get past where Paul changed everything, and then appreciate him as Jews. He wanted me to write an endorsement for the book. I thought, how can I write an endorsement when I thoroughly differ with it? But I did write a book saying, hey, it's great to see an Orthodox rabbi receiving Yeshua is a rabbi. We can say America's most famous rabbi meets the most famous rabbi of all time and then explain where I differed. But God moved on me to write a response that has become a standalone book that is the number one thing I've ever written to give to a Jewish person. You're talking to them and they want to find out more about the Messiah. This is the book. He wrote Kosher Jesus. I wrote the real Kosher Jesus. And yes, he endorsed my book. It's the number one book I wrote to give to a Christian, to show that Christian what it means to really follow Jesus Yeshua, who he really is. We've got a great special offer with the book, with a great free DVD that comes with it, with my testimony dramatized. Go to AskDrBrown.org to find out more. AskDrBrown.org. My bottom line today, there really are consequences when the church loses sight of who Yeshua is and of Israel's place in God's plan of salvation. You've got Jewish questions, we've got Jewish answers, Jewish news updates right here today on Thoroughly Jewish Thursday.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, welcome to The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. If you have a Jewish-related question of any kind, an Israel-related question, a Hebrew question, if you want to challenge some of my theology having to do with Israel and Jewish people, phone lines are open, 866-34-TRUTH. You can also tweet your question to me at Dr. Michael L. Brown, Dr. Michael L. Brown. Dr. Michael L. Brown. Make sure you get those two L's in the middle, Michael L. You can tweet your questions there or go to my Facebook page, Ask Dr. Brown, A-S-K-D-R Brown on Facebook, and I'll be answering these questions during the broadcast and have some news of interest that will keep you up to date with as well. Sean asked this on Facebook. This might be a different question. In researching my roots, I ran across the possibility that my surname, Lehman, L-E-H-M-A-N, may be of Jewish or German Jewish origin. Did you ever hear the name Lehman associated with Jewish family? Sure, absolutely. Could well be. See what you discover. Debbie, do the Jews also have the book of Revelation in their scriptures? And if not, how do they see the end times? Debbie, the book of Revelation is not part of the Jewish canon of scripture. Traditional Jews do not accept any of the books of the New Testament as canonical scripture. Their canon of scripture is what we would call the Old Testament, and then they lean heavily on the rabbinic writings, which preserve their traditions and teachings. So just like the Catholic Church uses the Bible and then additional books called the apocryphal books, they say they're all part of the Bible, and then Catholic tradition, Judaism uses what we call the Old Testament, and then scores of rabbinic books, which are holy to them, which are written after the time of the New Testament. And these pass on the traditions, the commentary, the teaching, the wisdom of the leaders, the application of the law, and things like that. And those books continue to be written to this very day. How do they see the end times? There is not an emphasis on eschatology, the end times in Judaism. There is far, far more emphasis on it in the Christian world, and even in the Muslim world. However, secular Jews are not thinking about the end times. Secular Jews are not even thinking about the resurrection or heaven and hell. Secular Jews have much more of a this world-oriented mindset. But traditional Jews are praying daily for the coming of the Messiah. They believe that he could be on the earth right now, that he won't be coming in the clouds of heaven, that he's a human being among us of Davidic descent, that he will be a preeminent teacher and scholar, that he will lead the Jewish people into obedience of the Torah, that he will regather Jewish exiles to the land of Israel, that he will rebuild the temple, that he will successfully fight against the nations that attack Israel, and that ultimately will establish God's kingdom on the earth, where Israel will be in the center and the Gentile nations will come to Jerusalem to learn from the God of Israel and to follow the model of the people of Israel. And then in eternity, there will just be the eternal age. And for many Jews, that means endless study of Torah in eternity. But as far as an end time scheme, they do believe in end time upheaval and shaking. They do believe that the Messiah will come and bring peace on the earth, but not before fighting the wars of the Lord. And that in the midst of this, that there will be times of calamity and tribulation. But in no way is it laid out in a systematized form with as much depth as you find in a lot of contemporary Christian teaching. 866-34-TRUTH. You've got Jewish-related questions on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. We've got Jewish-related answers for you. We'll be back with much more. And the rising tide of anti-Semitism.
God of burning, cleansing flame, send the
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thoroughly Jewish Thursday on The Line of Fire. Michael Brown, thanks so much for tuning in. 866-34-TRUTH. Taking your Jewish-related questions, some Twitter questions. Noel, how do we go from the Gentile question at the Jerusalem Council, Acts 15, to the Jewish question addressed at Nicaea? Noel, of course, this is very, very major. Acts 15, what was the question? Can you be a Gentile and believe in Jesus without becoming a Jew first? Some of the believers said, no, you got to be circumcised, follow the law of Moses. In other words, this is Israel's Messiah, so you got to get to Israel's club in order to experience Israel's Messiah. You ever go to eat at some country club and someone says, I can get you in because I'm a member here? Well, you got to be a member of the club for the benefits. You got to convert. Gentiles have to convert. And Peter and others said, no, we're saved by grace. They're saved by grace just as we are. Don't put this burden on them. That was the whole miracle of the new covenant, that Jew and Gentile could now be one in Jesus the Messiah. That Jew and Gentile could now be one without Gentiles having to become Jews. And that they could experience the same spiritual benefits. Wow. Well, over the centuries, that changed to the point the question was, can you be Jewish and follow Jesus? Or do you have to become a Gentile? Look, I have friends of mine, Jewish-believing friends, when they got saved, someone gave them a ham sandwich to, quote, prove they were really saved. In the Middle Ages, there are baptismal formulas that were used. I cite them in my book, Our Hands Are Stained with Blood. I refer to these things in the Real Kosher Jesus, our special research offer this week, Real Kosher Jesus, where there were baptismal formulas in the Middle Ages where when a Jew was, quote, converting to Catholicism, they had to renounce everything Jewish. They had to say, we won't give our kids Hebrew names. We'll have no association with Sabbath, with Passover, with anything like that. We'll break our ties with the Jewish community. We'll eat pork. We'll revere Mary. We'll curse the rabbis to get baptized. How did this happen? The church got arrogant because of ignorance. Romans 11, Paul warned about it. Don't boast against the branches. If you do, remember, you don't support the branches support you. The church became arrogant because of ignorance. And as a result of that, brought on terrible spiritual destruction, not just for the Jewish people, but for Christians as well. That's why you see so much apostasy and so much coldness and so much traditionalism. One reason being the church became arrogant based on ignorance. What was the ignorance? The ignorance was thinking God was through with Israel. The ignorance was in harmony with a debate I did with Dr. Don Preston, a gracious man, a scholarly man, a preterist scholar. But he said there's no controversy during our debate yesterday. There's no controversy over the fact that God finished dealing with Israel in 70 AD, cut them off. That was it. That's an abhorrent statement, very abhorrent statement. It makes God into a liar based on the unconditional promises he gave earlier, that he then takes them back. He gives an unconditional promise and then takes it back. I pledge my life to you for the rest of my life, you know, husband and wife, as long as we both shall live, no matter what, unless I find somebody I like better. No, that wasn't part of the vow. So these, to me, strike fundamentally at the integrity of God and the integrity of his promises and his trustworthiness. So Christians began to think, God's through with Israel. God's finished with Israel. We're the new kids on the block. We've replaced them. And then that ignorance, there became the arrogance. And then with that arrogance, the detaching from the roots, so that now something that was a Jewish movement that included Gentiles became a Gentile movement that excluded Jews unless they became Gentiles. Very, very serious. Lee on Twitter asks, are Jews ashamed of biblical heritage? Many love the customs, deny divine right to the land, avoid being fanatic, vote Democrat. The main reason, Lee, is because of liberalism, humanism, and secularism. That's the main reason. In other words, traditional Jews are absolutely proud of their Jewish and biblical heritage and will wear that out even in places where there's hostility towards them as Jews. And either they believe that God will bring the Jewish people back to the land when the Messiah comes, or that right now is a divine work, but they recognize ultimately that the land belongs to Israel. And they don't mind being radical in their convictions, but it's the majority of Jews today are more secular, are more liberal, And in that sense, there could be some degree of shame of some of the biblical teachings. Some of them are ashamed of the ultra-Orthodox. They may admire them on the one hand, and boy, you know, they're really living this out and preserving our traditions. But many are ashamed. They look at them and they say they're fanatical, they're extremists, they make us all look bad. You know, they're no different than the Muslim extremists, except they're not killing people, but they're just as radical and just as extreme. So some are ashamed of that. And if you don't believe in a sovereign God who specifically chose Israel for specific divine purposes, then you're not going to recognize the divine right to the land and things like that. 866-34-TRUTH. The beginning of the Reform Jewish movement, there was a real distancing a couple hundred plus years ago in Germany, a real distancing from Jewish distinctives. You know, that God chose Israel and gave us the Torah. That sounds too ethnocentric and proud. And the dietary laws seem so separatistic. And the laws of sacrifice seem so antiquated. So to this day, the Reformed Jewish prayer book is different than the traditional Jewish prayer book because certain things traditional Jews pray for every day, Reformed Jews don't. 866-34-TRUTH. We'll start in Bozeman, Montana. Bruce, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you, Dr. Brown. My question is actually about the Hebrew in 1 Samuel 10, verses 6 and 10 and 11. That's the story, if you remember, about, you know, just before Saul's coronation and yep. Samuel sending him out, all that. And the specific question is about the word that most translations translate as prophesy. From the root Navah, as you know. But the curiosity to me is I'm looking at an older version of the JPS, Tanakh, and cross-referencing it with a 1999 version. And in the 1999 version, it actually translates that in every case as spoken ecstasy as opposed to prophesy, which I thought was kind of interesting, personally coming from a charismatic background myself and knowing the term that is sometimes used in terms of ecstatic utterances.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah, the form of the verb, Bruce, is what's called hit pael, which can be reflexive, but not always. For example, if I said hit labashti, I dressed myself. So it's the root lavash, which is to clothe. But then when it's used in the hit pael, it can be, not always, but it can be reflexive of doing something to oneself. Or it can have some other type of nuance. So here, the root nava, from whence we get navi, prophet, or navi, prophet, and nava are related roots. It occurs in the hit pael here. Now, the fact is, there are plenty of times where it simply means prophesy. Ezekiel 37:10, I prophesied as he commanded me, and that's in the hit pael. It doesn't always have a specific meaning. For example, Jeremiah 23:13, as I'm just looking at different references, that the prophets are told to prophesy there, they're prophesying false things, and it's, again, reflexive in its usage. However, there are instances where it does seem to speak of an ecstatic state. For example, the Brown Driver Briggs Lexicon, which is a very exhaustive older dictionary, 100 years old but still usable today, they define this in part as prophesy under influence of divine spirit in the ecstatic state, and they use as examples Numbers 11, 1 Samuel 10. The better examples would be 1 Samuel 19, when Saul sends messengers to take David. When they come to the company of the prophets, the Spirit comes on them, and they begin to prophesy. And then it ends up with Saul himself gets there, and he begins to prophesy. It can be used in some cases of false prophets. That's why the JPS version, it's actually from the 80s, but you may have a 99 printing of it, says, 1 Samuel 10:6, the Spirit of the Lord will grip you and you will speak in ecstasy along with them. So it's definitely talking about prophetic speech, but it may be talking about being gripped in a unique way or being gripped for the first time, in which case people are more overcome by this. Does it compare with certain Pentecostal experiences today? I think so.
Yeah, and that was basically my question, is could you use this as a possible, for lack of a better word, a precursor to God moving in a certain, in a similar way on individuals as he did in the course?
Yeah, but the best one is Numbers 11, and it's the same form of the verb that's used there. Numbers 11, when God puts the spirit that was on Moses on all the 70, and they begin to prophesy. And Moses says, I wish all God's people could prophesy. That, to me, is the best example. But great point. I'm with you.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Tap your foot with me. Oh, yeah. Paul Wilbur. That's a good song to do a Messianic Jewish dance to. That is a great song to do. Worship the Lord with joy and... Problem is, you got to know the moves. I mean, they hold hands and you spin this way and you turn that way, and so it's great celebration though. Joyous. Paul's an anointed man too. 866-34-TRUTH. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Catching up on some Jewish related news and taking your Jewish related questions. Okay, FBI is reporting on Reuters that it thwarted Islamic State inspired attacks on July 4th. U.S. authorities thwarted plots to kill people in the United States around the July 4th holiday, FBI Director James Comey said on Thursday. Comey told reporters more than 10 people inspired by the Islamic State's recruitment online have been arrested over the past 4 weeks, some of which were focused on attacks around the July 4th holiday. FBI and the Department of Homeland Security issued a warning to local law enforcement to be on alert for attacks around July 4th. No such attacks occurred, but obviously... our government is working to stop them. Israel every day stops, God knows the exact number, but many, let's say in the course of a week, Israel is stopping many terror attacks every week, things that never get to happen because Israel is stopping it in advance. 866-34-TRUTH. We go to Fayetteville, North Carolina. Joel, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, thanks, Dr. Brown. My question is, is it correct to interpret the burden that Peter talks about in Acts 15 as being Jew rather than the law? Because there is a misconception in today's day, like, the law is bad. But I believe Peter is talking about the burden of being a Jew in the light of all the persecution, being taken captive, just because fell into God's standard. And my other question is, those religious Jews today believe in sending their kids to secular school rather than religious school? And if so, you know, why we don't do the same, sending our kids to religious school to protect our community?
Yep.
That's my two questions.
Yeah. Regarding the second question, traditional Jews absolutely do not send their kids to secular schools. It is part of... their heavy emphasis on studying Jewish tradition and their heavy emphasis on putting Jewish things first, so that they all have their own schools. The more religious, the more that's the case. It would be completely unthinkable for them to send their kids to secular schools. In fact, some of them have to be forced to teach secular subjects in their schools because they just want them to learn Jewish literature and Jewish tradition day and night. As far as believers, many homeschool. A larger number probably send their kids to Christian schools, and then many send their kids to public schools. And some of them do it feeling that we're in the world but not of it. Some of them do it because there is not a financial way. In the traditional Jewish community, there's more of a tight-knit working together so that there are going to be funds given together so that everyone's going to be able to send their kids to school and things like that. whereas we don't have that network. We're so much more diverse and spread out. But I do believe that if we as Christian leaders make statements and say you need to pull your kids out of the public school, that then we need to figure out ways to finance that, because not everyone can afford to send their kids to a Christian school, or can afford to or is able to homeschool. Again, there are kids that I know that have gone to secular schools and it's destroyed them, and other kids that have gone to secular schools and they're world changers. So everyone has to work that out for themselves. But the principle, would Israel send their kids to the Canaanites for education? You know, it would be that stark for a traditional Jew. Regarding Acts 15, no, I don't read it the way you're saying it. I mean, Peter is quite explicit here in what he says. He says, brothers, you are aware that in the early days God made a choice among you that by my mouth the Gentiles would hear the gospel message and believe. And God, who knows the heart, testified to them by giving them the Holy Spirit just as he also did to us. He made no distinction between us and them, cleansing their hearts by faith. Now then, why are you testing God by putting a yoke on the disciples' necks that neither our ancestors nor we have been able to bear, which is, unless you're circumcised and obey the law of Moses, you can't be saved. On the contrary, we believe that we are saved through the grace of the Lord Jesus in the same way they are. That ends Peter's speech, and those are the last words spoken by Peter, interestingly, in the book of Acts. So it's not a matter of it's hard to be a Jew because of persecution and judgment. Rather, Peter is saying no to what the Pharisees said. It is necessary to circumcise them and to command them to keep the law of Moses. Israel continually fell because although the law was perfect, they were not. And this was a covenant written on stone, not written on their hearts, because of which Israel would fall continually under divine judgment. It's like someone put a basketball net 20 feet high and said to me, here's the ball. You need to go up and jam that. You need to stuff that ball through the net with your own jumping, or you can't eat today. Well, I would starve to death because I wouldn't be able to jump that high. So to put that on the Gentiles would bring the same damnation on them. So the law of the Lord is good and wonderful and beautiful, but the Sinai covenant itself brought death, not because it was imperfect, but because of the imperfection of man. And to now tell Gentiles that in order to be saved, you're required to keep the law of Moses and be circumcised is going backwards, not forwards, is putting them under the bondage of justification by the law rather than the freedom of forgiveness and grace. Now by grace, God writes his sacred laws on our heart, and the moral requirements of the Torah, loving God, loving our neighbors, ourselves, and the aspects of living that out in this world, that's now written in our hearts, and we are empowered by grace to live that out. Thank you, Joel, for the questions. 866-34-TRUTH. I'm going to get to some more Facebook and Twitter questions and your phone calls as well. So you're talking to a Jewish person, and they want to find out more about Jesus. Where do you send them? Get them my book, The Real Kosher Jesus. It will be an eye-opener for them. Yes, Jewish people are coming to faith by reading that book. And it's written in a way that will draw them in, especially if they've read Rabbi Shmuley's book, Kosher Jesus, that my book responds to. You're a Christian. You want to find out aspects about the Messiah, hidden truths about the Messiah in the Bible that you may not have known, hidden truths that come alive through the light of Jewish tradition that I'm sure you never knew before unless you heard us teach on them. We open these things up. We even explain how God used Paul in a genius way that you may not have seen before. The book is a page-turner. The sweetest testimony I heard was when a gentleman finished reading it, he broke down crying because he was so enjoying the adventure and the journey that he didn't want it to end. When you order the book today, we're giving you free with it, and we're paying the postage, a DVD of my testimony from LSD to PhD from the Think It Through TV series, and I recorded it right in the town where I grew up and did the crazy drug thing. So a wonderful free gift. Call 1-800-278-9978 to order. 1-800-278-9978. That's 1-800-278-9978. Order as many copies as you want. Or to find out more, go to askdrbrown.org.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
The voice of Chazakim, or the voices of Chazakim. Yeshua mi Nazrat ben David, Jesus from Nazareth, son of David. 866-34-TRUTH. Jimmy, do you think Julian's failed attempt at rebuilding the Jewish temple in the 4th century was because of Israel's punishment? I think anyone that tries to rebuild anything of prophetic significance before the time is not going to be able to do it. I'd say it's that simple. Let's see. Frazier. What was the ancient Jewish interpretation of Jeremiah 23:6, which says the Messiah would be called the Lord our righteous Savior? Actually, you mean the Lord our righteousness, Yahweh Tzidkenu. I'm not aware of ancient Jewish interpretation on this that would predate the time of the New Testament, but traditional Jewish interpretation would see this not as saying that the Messiah, the branch, is Yahweh, but rather that the Messiah's name is Yahweh is our righteousness, or Yahweh is our vindicator, or vindication. In other words, you can have a name like Eliyahu, right? My God is Elijah. My God is Yahweh. My God is Yah. You're not saying something about the person. You're saying something about that person's God. So it would be the name of the Messiah, Yahweh is our righteousness, or Yahweh is our vindication, and that's his name, rather than his name being Yahweh our righteousness. That's how it would be understood. And it is possible to understand it either way in Hebrew. But we can make a case for the fact that no one has the full Yahweh word in their name. It's always a shortened form, like you have in Yehoshua, Joshua. It's a shortened form, or Eliyahu that I just mentioned, or Hizkiyahu, or Yeshayahu, Hezekiah, or Isaiah. They're always shortened forms. So to actually have Yahweh in the name is highly unusual, and that could point to divine identification there. Tanya, I spoke to a Jewish man about abortion recently. He said the Jewish view is that life begins at birth. Is this true? Is he overstating the facts in order to justify all abortions? And is this view one of the reasons why abortion is so high in Israel? Abortion is high in Israel because Israel is primarily secular rather than religious. Even though your average Israeli has a recognition of the Jewish calendar and certain aspects of the God of Israel, they are more secular and decent amount are atheists. And then you have the very traditional Jews and then those that are traditional but not as traditional. So the reason that Israel has a high abortion rate is because of secular humanism, because of Israelis throwing off a biblical worldview and throwing off Torah and just living like the rest of the world in the flesh. Traditional Judaism would see in the opening days of pregnancy, so over the first month plus, that the baby is not a fully formed human being, but that immediately after that, so say 40 days in, that child is a full human being and abortion would be wrong except to save the life of the mother. So what he was saying was false, completely false. There is the Jewish joke that a priest, a pastor, and a rabbi were asked, when does life begin? And the priest said, oh, that's clear. Our church has teaching it begins at conception. And the Protestant pastor, who was kind of liberal, said, you know, there's a lot of discussion. Some say conception, some say during the pregnancy, some say when the child's born. We're still debating that. And the rabbi said, we believe life begins when the children leave home. Okay, just a little joke. But no, he misstated things. He was in error. That is not what Judaism teaches. 866-34-TRUTH. We'll be right back with your Jewish-related phone calls here on The Line of Fire.
Give us strength to always do what's right. It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
You know, I used to be part of a leadership team with Paul Wilbur, and sometimes right before we would begin to have our meeting, Paul would take out his guitar and we'd have a time of worship, and we'd never get to the meeting. He'd just begin to play and sing, and we'd begin to worship, and maybe an hour would go by. We'd just be caught up in worship because of the anointing on his life and because of our heart to worship the Lord. So I need to get into another service where Paul leads worship. I can preach. We do something together. Got to make that happen. 866-34-TRUTH. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Let's see here. Lalo, I would like to know more about the crypto Jews, the Anosim, and the Muranos. Muranos, pigs, as Jewish converts to Catholicism were called. Anosim, these were hidden Jews. In many cases, Jews outwardly converted to Catholicism to save their lives in the aftermath of the Crusades and during the Crusades. They outwardly converted, but they continued to secretly practice Judaism. The best theories on the Inquisition are that the Inquisition began to purge these people from the church, that the Inquisition was looking for Christians who were still secretly living as Jews so as to purge them out of the Catholic Church. And that was the origin of the heresy-seeking Spanish Inquisition that then expanded into other Inquisitions in different countries. Now, in some cases, these crypto-Jews or secret Jews continued to practice for many, many years within the Gentile Catholic culture in which they lived, and then at a certain point lost track of that, that either intermarriage or just as generations went on. Obviously, some just fully became Catholic, Gentile. Others returned to Judaism. But there are legitimately Hispanic people today who feel drawn, they don't really know why, drawn to Jewish roots of the faith and drawn to Sabbath observance, or have a boy and feel they're supposed to circumcise him on the eighth day, and they really don't know why. And then they study their family history and find out that, in fact, there is a lot of Jewish blood running in their veins. 866-34-TRUTH. All right, let's go to our friend Charles in Lancaster, Texas. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Dr. Brown, hey, I'm so glad that you're raising the issues of just, you know, restoring the Jewish roots of the faith. I'm not Jewish, but boy, I tell you, the scriptures have totally opened since I have been studying these subjects, these topics, you know, in the Jewish roots of the faith. It's really opened up a lot of things. In fact, understanding the nature of God and hearing your teaching on that, it's amazing. So, I wanted to ask you about the Nazarenes, the first followers of Jesus. I've read some things, just like reading your book, Our Hands Are Stained with Blood, and I'm appalled. I'm just out of words and sorrow with just the history that's taken place since, you know, the time Jesus left, and even before then. Just the history that the Jewish people had, what they've struggled with, but you know, it's embarrassing, you know, just to look at church history and see what's been done. I'm reading, you know, some quotes from Epiphanius and Jerome, and of course, you know, Martin Luther. Just the things that were said. It's like, what in the world were they thinking?
Yeah,
you know, because
it's shy. It's not just that they got it wrong, but they got it wrong in such ugly, ugly, despicable, unchristian ways. But the Nazarenes, you have different groups that preserve some form of Jewishness while following Jesus in the early centuries. And some were absolute mainstream, like Paul and Peter and the others, who lived as Jews while following Jesus, Yeshua. who continue to be identified as Jews and who live by the biblical calendar and things like that. We see Paul very clearly saying this is how he lives in Acts, and saying that he does not teach Jews who are following Jesus to abandon the law of Moses and the customs. They're just doing it now in the life of the Spirit. There are different groups. There are the Ebionites, who seem to hold to some heretical views, either a denial of Yeshua's divinity, denial of his virgin birth, or denial of the teaching of Paul. Another group called the Corinthians, not Corinthians, but Corinthians. And then the Nazarenes. And from what we can see, and the easiest book to read on this is Ray Pritz's book on Nazarene Jewish Christianity. It seems that they held to all the main lines of the faith. They were misunderstood by much of the church, which had so lost sight of its Jewish roots that people living like the apostles lived became increasingly strange to them. And basically, the Jewish community was telling Jewish believers, if you want to be part of us, you got to get rid of Jesus. And the church was telling these Jewish believers, if you want to be part of us, you got to get rid of your Jewishness. And they did neither. But from what we could see, and we don't have their writings preserved originally, but some of their teachings Jerome preserves in his Isaiah commentary, and we have other scattered references to what they would have taught and believed, they rejected the authority of rabbinic Judaism. They rejected the teaching of the rabbis, but they continued to live as Jews, and they revered Yeshua as the divine Messiah, and they accepted the full canon of New Testament scripture. They survived at least 300-400 years. Some even claim even to the dawning of the Muslim age, so 600-700 years. Of course, they've been restored now through the Messianic Jewish movement. And that's who we would look back to as the ones that we are emulating as Messianic Jews. We would say we're just like the early apostles, the first Jewish believers, and those that were called Nazarenes. There is an extensive collection of all of the relevant writings by two Dutch scholars, Klein and Hofthuizer, and they have them in Greek and Latin and then translated into English. But Ray Pritz draws on that collection and, based on that collection, puts together a very practical book. But it tells us that even pretty early on, the church leaders had a hard time with a Jew following Jesus as a Jew. They struggled with that. Always nice to talk to you, Charles. Keep up your studies, and thanks for your broken heart over the errors of the church in the past. We go to Highlands, North Carolina. We don't go there. Let's go to Jerusalem. Michael, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. It's an honor. I love your show. I found it inspirational. I want to tell you my story very briefly. I was raised in a Jewish family, going to a Messianic Jewish congregation. As I grew up, I felt a strong identity and pull toward traditional Judaism. I traveled to different synagogues. I got to know different rabbis. I never gave up my belief in Yeshua, but I now feel very at home in a synagogue, you know, as a Jew praying. And I feel like it's not a perfect situation, because in a way I sort of keep quiet. You know, I don't volunteer information about what I believe. But on the other hand, I don't feel like there's a Messianic synagogue that's really tailor-made for me. So I wanted to know what your opinion would be for people like me.
I would go to a church where Jesus was praised and exalted in the most Christian terms, or to a Messianic congregation where Jesus was exalted in the most Christian terms, so that you can recover his centrality. Because if you're more at home in a synagogue where the prayers are not recognizing the coming of the Messiah, where those people, if the Messiah walked into that room, would reject him again, where if they found my books on answering Jewish objections to Jesus, they'd tear them up. If you're more at home praying there, then fellowshipping and worshiping with Messianic Jews or with Christians who recognize Yeshua as Lord and Messiah and who worship him and honor him and reverence him, then your heart's going in the wrong direction, and it's dangerous. And Jewishness is more important to you than Yeshua. That's what I would say.
Okay. I
Now, let me just say this.
That's a little harsh, honestly.
But... well, let me just say this. When you go in for surgery and the doctor cuts you to take out a tumor, it's a little harsh, but he's doing it to save your life. I've watched this for decades, Michael. Decades. I've watched people ultimately deny Yeshua. What you need to do is take out a hymn book that praises Jesus Christ and sing the hymns, and because that's how he's worshipped and adored around the world. And then fine, if you're more at home in a Messianic congregation, great. Go to King of Kings. Go. You live in Jerusalem, man. There's Ahavat Yeshua there. There are other Messianic congregations there. Is it Odeh Cheshire? There are a bunch of fine Messianic congregations in Jerusalem, man. You've got to be at home in one of them. And then go to Christ Church and worship Jesus. Get your priorities straight. And then you can really pray for the lost sheep of Israel.
God of light, hear our cry. Send the fire.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
I talked about it in the first hour. I'm going to talk about it again now. When Jewishness becomes more central than Yeshua, you're in big trouble. When Jewishness becomes more central than Jesus, you're in big trouble. If you can't, as an English speaker, say, Jesus Christ is Lord, because of the negative associations with the term Jesus Christ in Jewish history, something's got to be broken there. There's a problem. If you can't take out a hymn that your brothers and sisters sing in worship and adoration of Jesus because it's too goyish, it's too Gentile, you're in trouble. You got a problem. You might love being in a Messianic congregation and might absolutely prefer saying Yeshua. Fine. Wonderful. But I've watched it for years. The Jewish temptation, the emphasis on Jewishness first and Yeshua second. And then you got to hide your identity in Yeshua. It cannot be right. That cannot be God. You end up being ashamed of the gospel. It fascinates, stimulates, complicates, suffocates. You find you're not witnessing to other people and telling them about Yeshua being the Savior. You find you're more concerned about not being discovered so that you can be among other Jews rather than seeing them saved. You even begin to question, is there Jewish salvation outside of Yeshua? Your own worship life goes down. It's just going to happen. And especially live in Jerusalem and not be able to find a Messianic congregation. I was just there. I just preached in a fine Messianic congregation. I know other fine Messianic congregations. And then on top of it, you have fine churches like King of Kings. You have Christ Church there. To not have it as the priority to worship with other followers of Jesus Yeshua and to find more harmony praying in a synagogue with Jewish people who do not know Yeshua, the more religious the synagogue, the more actively and consciously they would reject him, who are praying prayers for God to do things that he has already done, to find more harmony there than in a Messianic congregation or church is absolutely problematic. Now, let me say this. If you're a member of a congregation, you're a vibrant worshiper of Jesus Yeshua, you are absolutely ablaze, and you just love to go to the synagogue to pray with fellow Jews, and it's your way to intercede and stay connected with your people. Hey, awesome! But that was not the case with our caller, hence the strength and clarity of my response. Durham, North Carolina. Ryan, welcome to the Line of Fire.
How you doing, Dr. Brown?
Doing well, thank you.
All honor and glory be to the Most High. I have a question I would like to get your input on in regards to Hosea 1, verses 10 and 11. I'm actually driving in the car. Is it possible that you could read it out?
Yes, sir. All right, so the specific thing you want me to focus on in Hosea 1 is... You want me to read verses 10 and 11?
Yes, sir.
All right. So this is after the prophecies of having children named Lo Ruchama, no compassion, and Lo Ami, not my people. Verse 10, yet the number of the Israelites will be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or counted. And in the place where they were told, you are not my people, they will be called sons of the living God. And the Judeans and the Israelites will be gathered together. They will appoint for themselves a single ruler and go up from the land, for the day of Jezreel will be great. Yeah, that is a restoration that we are still looking forward to. Some have wrongly taken the reference to Israelites as referring to Gentiles or the church. No, it is speaking of the northern tribes. And it is saying that there will be a great restoration. all 12 tribes together, and ultimately following one ruler, one Messiah, who will bring them back to the land. So it is speaking of something that has not yet happened.
Is it? Well, it says that they will appoint someone. Well, it's kind of hard to see that as the Messiah.
Yeah, well, again, that's a perfectly legitimate point to make there. The fact of the matter is that when appoint could simply mean recognize. I mean, you could read it as not referring directly to the Messiah. You know, you could read it as saying that it's just talking about saying, okay, we need to go back to the land, and someone's going to lead us back. I'm just looking at the Hebrew. V'samulahem rosh echad. Yeah, I mean, the point for themselves, one head, can also, if they recognize him as the Messiah, you be our leader, you be our king, it could mean that as well. So it could either be talking on a lesser level of saying, okay, we're appointing you to bring us back together, but it could well mean recognizing who he is and say, okay, we embrace you now as our king, as our leader.
Okay, do you know which land they're referring to?
Oh yeah, of course, the land of Israel. Of course, that's the land
where they said they would not be called God's people.
No, when there was a time when they were alienated and under judgment, and even though they still belonged to the Lord, they were not identifying as God's people, and God was putting them in exile and bringing them under judgment as if they were not His people. But He said, "I'm going to restore you." Now, Paul allegorically uses that, or metaphorically uses that, to speak of the Gentiles, that you were the ultimate not my people. You were the ones who were absolutely not the people of God, and now you've become the people of God. How much more will that apply for the people of Israel, who have always been loved by God? But at times, He said, I have to divorce you. I'm going to divorce you, but then I'm going to restore you. Hey, Ryan, I got to run, but thank you so much for very good questions. Maybe we could explore them a little bit more at another time. Let's go to Bria, California. Bernice, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown.
Hello.
First, can you hear me?
Yep.
Oh, first I want to congratulate you for your great accomplishments on your fitness and health. I'm really, really excited about you, and it's a great testimony for us to follow your steps as, you know, not just a great theologian and man of God, but also taking care of your own body. Thank you for that.
Well, you're very welcome. I'm thrilled. I'm happy, blessed, thriving, and grateful to God's intervention and my wife's help and the wisdom of Dr. Joel Fuhrman. All right, we're real short on time, but go for your question. But thank you for that.
Yes. Well, I just want to have a clarification on Acts 15:20.
Yeah.
I've been reading and I've been studying on my Jewish roots of my faith. I'm a Gentile Christian, and I've noticed that there is a specific mandate per se for the Gentiles as far as abstaining from food, you know, and for a specific. So I would
I'm just going to jump in real quick, just because we're out of time. So let me answer. The abstaining from things polluted by idols, sexual immorality, eating anything that's been strangled from blood, these would have been requirements that later became known as the seven laws of Noah, basic requirements for Gentiles. But these would have been the fundamentals of the fundamentals to make sure that Gentiles understood this, especially if there was to now be incorporation in the same body with Jewish people. It's not the end all. The epistles tell us more in terms of what's required, but this is a beginning. It's also possible sexual immorality referred specifically to incest, and these incestuous relationships that would have been acceptable among Gentiles were now God was saying, these are off. But this was a starting point. This was a beginning, but God never required Gentiles to keep all of the law of Moses. Hey, I got to run. We can take this up another day. Remember to check out our special resource offer by going to AskDrBrown.org. My bottom line today, the great answer for Israel, the great answer for the world is a rabbi named Yeshua.